From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. In Baghdad, the heaviest bombardment in days today, huge explosions and anti-aircraft fire filled the night sky again. Before war began, there were expectations, perhaps naive, perhaps deliberately or inadvertently cultivated, that it would be won in a Baghdad minute. That has not happened. Iraqi forces are fighting back. U.S.-led troops have been walloped by sandstorms and slowed by surprise attacks. Supply lines are long and insecure. It appears that Saddam is very much alive. Tonight on Point, the time factor in war with Iraq. How long will it take? We begin in Washington with the latest developments. John Diamond is Pentagon correspondent for USA Today and joins us now. Good evening. Welcome, John Diamond.
Great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. John, what's the latest today? We hear just before we come in, we came in this evening of new missile attacks, heavy attacks on Baghdad.
There are heavy attacks on Baghdad. There's also reports of new clashes involving Marines around al-Nasiriyah, with 25 reported wounded or missing after the fighting. We've got the first contact between U.S. forces and members of the Republican Guard in the vicinity of Najaf, due south of Baghdad. And it appears we have a large battle brewing with Republican Guard forces outside of Karbala, which is a little bit closer to Baghdad, also to the south. So the coming 2 to 4 days could be quite important to the development of this war.
Let's take Nasiriyah first. It's well south of Baghdad, and as far as we know, I don't think it's staffed, if you will, by Republican Guard troops. These are regulars or even irregulars. Is
that
right?
That's right, and it's been a real obstacle for U.S. forces. It's a major crossroads city on the Euphrates River. It's been a crossing point for both Marines and Army forces. There's been a decision to bypass it for the main convoy of supplies going north for the Army, but the Marines needed to secure bridge crossings there to get themselves in position for an approach to Baghdad more from the southeast. And so they have been able to secure those bridges, but it's been an almost constant firefight around that town.
So are troops and material flowing across those bridges, or are they not able to in the midst of the firefight?
They are able to move stuff to the north, but not in the quantities needed to get ready for the Battle of Baghdad, if you will. And that battle may be slow in developing unless the Iraqis try to take the fight to the U.S. forces.
Is that possible? There's talk today that U.S. forces, northernmost forces on the south side of Baghdad, need more time to pull in reinforcements. Is it possible the Republican Guard may come out and take it straight to them?
They do, and they might. It might not be such a great idea because the weather report is for clear weather. And essentially, with the U.S. military, the way it's configured these days, any force in the open can be destroyed from the air. So it would be a risky proposition unless it were a nighttime attack. And even then, the heat signatures put off by a moving military force show up as bright lights on the targeting screens of U.S. warplanes. So very dangerous for the Iraqis to do that. Nevertheless, there are indications that the Army, the U.S. 3rd Infantry Division, is struggling to get the fuel, food, water, ammunition it needs to wage this battle. And there is a sort of latter-day version of what we saw in World War II with the Red Ball Express running equipment through a gauntlet of small arms fire all the way up the 250 miles from the Kuwaiti border.
We read about heroic efforts on the part of those truck convoys to get supplies to the northernmost troops there, but there's also an awful lot of conversation flying around today about how long this war may take. What are you hearing at the Pentagon today on that front, John Diamond?
I guess the watchword would be months, not weeks, and I think that barring a sort of sudden and total collapse of Iraqi opposition, which is always a possibility, it would be something akin to what we saw in Afghanistan. Barring that kind of collapse, which does not appear to be in the offing right now, every move that the U.S. forces are making suggests weeks and months of fighting. You have the opening of the Northern Front, which we talked about yesterday.
These are the paratroopers, 1,000 paratroopers who came in the Kurdish-held area.
That's right, and it appears that their role is going to be to clear the way for a much larger force that's going to flow in via air transport into that region, possibly, but it will take many weeks to get a significant force in with vehicles coming in by aircraft to assemble a critical mass that could threaten the very strong Iraqi forces to the south.
John, there was so much apprehension about ending up in the heat of the desert summer there, which begins fairly soon in April, I believe. Mm. Is that now inevitable that U.S. troops will be there and fighting through that Iraqi summer?
Well, my reading of the Iraqi weather charts indicates that the really hot weather doesn't get here until mid-May. So there's still some time to get some things done. But we are looking, for example, at the 4th Infantry Division, a very powerful U.S. force, one of the most modern in the, perhaps the most modern in the U.S. Army in terms of its technology, arriving in Kuwait perhaps in mid-April. And it will at that point only be at the beginning of its road up to a potential battlefield.
And then, of course, we've seen how long it takes to get those ships unloaded and everything in gear and out of crates and on the road.
Right. The U.S. military, going all the way back to the Civil War, has been a very logistically heavy military organization, moving tremendous amounts of fuel and food. It's an army that marches on its stomach. These are not, you know, guerrilla warriors who are eating worms and grubs. There's just a tremendous amount of physical movement of stuff that goes with the putting this kind of an army into the field.
And, John, last question, but beyond the briefing room at the Pentagon, what are you hearing from military officials there? Is there disgruntlement with this timetable, or this is just the way it's got to be?
There are folks in the U.S. Army who are really angry. They're not quite ready yet to go on the record to say it, but they're quite angry that a larger force was not put in to begin with, that they were made to wait to get the full-up force into Iraq. This rolling start concept. The other big thing that you hear as a concern is that if the Iraqi forces essentially back into Baghdad and wage a street battle, this could get extremely ugly and costly and dangerous. The third indication, I think, of trouble is that the very best Iraqi division called the Adnan Division, is north of Baghdad near the Tikrit area, which is Saddam's central home. Mm-hmm. And there seems to be some suggestion that the Iraqis are planning to make that their last stand. So we could be looking at not one but two major urban-type battles before this war is over.
That's quite a picture. John Diamond, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
John Diamond is Pentagon correspondent for USA Today. He spoke with us from Washington. Today's Washington Post reports war with Iraq could last longer than many expected, including top commanders. Some senior U.S. military officials, says the Post, are now convinced that the war is likely to last months and will require considerably more combat power than is now on hand. Today at Camp David, here's how President Bush responded to a reporter's question about how long the war could go on.
However long it takes. That's the answer to your question, and that's what you got to know.
So just how long is however long it takes? Days, weeks, months, more? Tonight on Point, the time factor in war with Iraq. Did you imagine a rough timetable for this war? Are we on it? Is America impatient, unrealistic, or misled? And how long is too long for Iraq, for U.S. troops, for you? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Anthony Cordesman, the Arleigh A. Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Good evening and welcome, Anthony Cordesman.
Good evening.
Thank you for being with us. And from Carlisle, Pennsylvania, Stephen Biddle, Professor of National Security Studies at the Strategic Studies Institute of the U.S. Army War College. Good evening and welcome, Professor Biddle.
Good evening. Good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Anthony Cordesman, what does this picture tell you? You've heard the reports from the Pentagon. You've read, like we all have, the rumbling and grumbling from officers off the briefing stage. President Bush today saying, however long it takes, what are we looking at in a time frame here for this war in Iraq?
Well, let's be careful about what we're saying. First, we have press reports of people grumbling about the war plan. But the fact is the war plan called for the 4th Mechanized Division to be in Turkey, to be fighting already, to be followed by the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment. It called for war to begin probably at least 6 weeks ago before the Iraqis were dispersed and prepared to the degree they are. It called for a softening up air campaign to be on for at least 3 days before major ground maneuvers began. It called for a different phasing of equipment, which had to be delayed for political reasons in the UN debate. So if there are people grumbling about the war plan rather than the political and diplomatic environment, it's because they never had access to the war plan.
It was a very tough environment that all this was born into. Where does it leave us?
Well, I think where it leaves us is that we are in a very dynamic situation. We're going to have to see how well the Iraqis can fight. If they do put up a stern defense of Baghdad and Tikrit, then all of these reinforcements that are now in place and coming are going to be absolutely critical. The willingness, though, of regimes like this to collapse catalytically, the way forces break down in a defense, is very unpredictable. People talk about the worst cases in urban warfare, and most times they don't occur. Urban warfare tends to be fairly brief. The enemy collapses, the political structure leaves. Mm-hmm. And remember another little problem here. Since this war began a week ago, there has been not one word about something like 3,000 attack sorties, their effectiveness. We've fired something on the order of 4,600 precision munitions. It's got to be having a tremendous war-fighting effect. It is one we have reasons to keep secret, but when you can't see half the war, it's probably a little, you know, reasonable to be a bit modest about what you say.
So are you suggesting by that that the Iraqi forces may in fact have been or be hollowed out by this campaign, or that we can't be sure they are?
Well, I'm saying we really don't know. And if you remember what happened in Afghanistan, we'd go on these daily stock market-like cycles of euphoria and optimism.
Yes.
Followed by pessimism. We did the same thing in Kosovo. And I think, frankly, if you don't have all the data, you certainly should raise the issues, but not go running off to make judgments before you have the evidence.
Well, that's exactly what we're looking for tonight, and for some recalibration of expectations. What range would you be putting on this tonight, Anthony Cordesman, as you look out across what we do know from weeks to what?
Well, all I can say is that several months ago I said it would probably be around 4 to 6 weeks of really intense fighting, depending on the resistance of the Iraqis. If they really resist, then it could be longer. But the other aspect of this that people need to understand, this won't be a neat peace. There'll be a lot of incidents and problems, Kurds, Turkmens, Shiites, Sunnis, regional issues, get-even problems, stability problems. We're not going to be out of there. We're not going to see American young men and women safe for a matter of months at a minimum. And people need to understand that peacemaking is going to be unpleasant, no matter how quickly a lot of the fighting ends.
Anthony Cordesman, I know we have to let you go, but I want to thank you very much for joining us tonight. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Anthony Cordesman is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Stephen Biddle, we've just got a minute here. You've been patient looking up to the break here, but what's your view on the timetable? How do we begin to think about what expectations ought to be? Or do we just set that aside, as President Bush suggested today, and imagine, well, it'll take as long as it takes, period?
Well, I think the main point is the one you hinted at a moment ago. The issue now is how to think about this whole issue of time. What do you gain and what do you lose by trying to wage war quickly, as opposed to being a bit more patient about it? I mean, strategy and strategy making is a question of balancing trade-offs. I mean, you can't have everything simultaneously. You can't have a very quick campaign, a very high probability of victory, very low casualties on our side, unless you get very fortunate and things break happily in your way. If you don't get those kind of breaks, then you face trade-offs. I mean, among the central trade-offs the administration has been looking at is a larger military effort, more forces in theater, will ordinarily bring about a quicker resolution of the conflict, but it creates a bigger footprint in the theater, runs the risk of making us look more like conquerors and less like liberators.
Stephen Biddle, hold the thought right there. We want to come back and look at exactly what those trade-offs might be. We're looking tonight at the time factor and how long this war in Iraq may last. Should the U.S. risk more casualties of its own and others if it would end the war more quickly? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the time factor and how long the war in Iraq may last. Did you have a timetable, a duration in mind for this war? What did you expect? What do you expect now? When President Bush says the U.S. will fight in Iraq for as long as it takes, what does that say to you? And wasn't this war supposed to be over before the heat of summer? Were we dreaming? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is Stephen Biddle, joining us from Carlisle, Pennsylvania. He's professor of national security studies at the Strategic Studies Institute of the U.S. Army War College and author of the forthcoming book, Military Power, Explaining Victory and Defeat in Modern Battle. Let's hear just a bit of British Prime Minister Tony Blair speaking today at a joint press conference with President Bush at Camp David.
We will carry on until the job is done. But there is absolutely no point, in my view, of trying to set a time limit or speculate on it, because it's not set by time. It's set by the nature of the job. All I would do, though, is point out to you that within those 6 or 7 days, actually an enormous amount has already been achieved.
Tony Blair, today at Camp David, what do you think? Is the length of this war now out of Washington's control? Does it now depend somehow on Iraqi resistance? We're at 1-800-423-8255 with Stephen Biddle, and also now joined by Richard Betts, director of the Institute for War and Peace Studies at Columbia University and author of Surprise Attack, Lessons for Defense Planning. Good evening and welcome, Richard Betts.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us. Stephen Biddle, just before the break, you were talking about the trade-offs that surround the time issue here. Describe some of those for us in a bit more detail, if you would.
Well, I mean, the administration would clearly like a short war. The longer the war goes on, the greater the opportunity there is for political unrest in the Mideast and elsewhere in the world to accumulate, and the more time the opponent has to adapt to what you're doing and think of clever new stratagems that can undo you in ways that you wouldn't necessarily have anticipated. But the way you would ordinarily bring about a short conclusion is by deploying a large force that's capable of decisive action. You deploy a large force in theater, that means lots of people, lots of visibility, something that looks an awful lot like a conquering army rather than necessarily a liberating force. So you can't have everything you want simultaneously. You have to either take risks or give up something or to get something else. The administration took some risks here. It has yet to be determined whether they're going to be happy with the risks they chose as opposed to the risks they didn't choose.
So you're suggesting there are political implications for how the war is conducted. Richard Betts, do those include calculations around casualties, American and Iraqi? With the force that we have there now, could the tempo of the war be stepped up if the fire was less discriminating, or would that be pointless?
Well, this will probably be more an issue when we get to actually moving into cities, especially Baghdad, because there, obviously, it will be very difficult to move fast and secure large areas without being very destructive. And that's, I think, where the issue will really be joined. So far, it hasn't been, I think, that big a choice. And although many people have been surprised by the fact of any significant Iraqi resistance, the fact remains that so far our casualties have been, by historic standards, not very high.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's in part, again, because we haven't been dealing with the most difficult combat situations of intense urban combat, which may be yet to come.
We're hearing and reading today lots of second-guessing within the U.S. military about the timetable and about the circumstances that U.S. forces are in right now. Of course, there's been this awful weather. There's everything Anthony Cordesman cited before. We weren't able to come in through Turkey. Things were pushed back by the long debate over whether or not there should be war. Now we have very long and clearly vulnerable supply lines. There are reports of troops at the front short of not enough food, water, ammunition, enough for right now, but not enough to go into battle with. Reinforcements a long way off. Is this just the kind of normal level of apprehension once a war begins, Stephen Biddle, or is there an extra level of apprehension because of the particular circumstances here?
Well, there's always apprehension, and there's always fog and uncertainty in war. I mean, there's a certain tendency to think that in the information age, everything is knowable, everything's predictable, everything's transparent. In war, none of the above holds. There's always going to be uncertainty. There's always going to be apprehension. Now, to some extent, the administration is is suffering some of the difficulties of its own press campaign. Because many had hoped that this would be a quick war inside and outside the military, when it turns out to be perhaps less dramatically short than people had hoped, you have more of an effect on people's emotions and psychology than would be the case if those expectations hadn't been there at the outset. But I think you'd have to look pretty hard to find many military planners at this point who think that it's completely unreasonable that a war like this could take more than a few days. I mean, hope may have been that it would be shorter, but I think military experience suggests to many that they have to at least be prepared for the possibility of a longer outcome, and certainly the plans had accommodated that possibility.
And Richard Betts, in the circumstances that the U.S. military now finds itself, what does it tell us about this new lighter war vision of a lighter warfare, of a rolling start? There was a well-publicized debate in and around the Pentagon before this war about how heavy we should go in, whether Gulf War heavy, half a million troops and all that, or whether we could go in lighter with the kind of Rumsfeld strategy. Is that strategy being, in some degree, discredited by the way things have turned out in the first week?
Well, it's still too soon to know. It is only 1 week.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly, the political leadership of the administration gambled on things breaking in a favorable way, and that our speed and skill and overwhelming power in combination with what was assumed to be a really weak and shallow Iraqi willingness to fight would all bring it crumbling down. They were prepared for the alternative, which we're facing now, but that obviously wasn't what they were hoping had high odds of happening. The move to Baghdad is in logistical terms really serious challenge for any force in the amount of time in which we've been moving, and especially given the constraints of the numbers of people to man the supply lines as well as do everything else. It's in a sense amazing that things have gone as well as they have in some regards.
Mm.
If we put the combat surprises to the side for the moment.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of range, Stephen Biddle, is it possible that even now Anthony Cordesman was talking about the catalytic collapse of forces that you can see? If the Republican Guard took a stiff hit or the bombing became unbearable on official centers in Baghdad, that we could see this end quickly? I'm reading some, again, armchair generals saying today the short-term pessimists may look right tonight, but they could still be proved wrong by mid-April. Within 10 days we could find out that the mettle of the Republican Guard isn't what it now looks like, and see it all kind of collapse.
I mean, it's certainly possible. The dynamics here are very hard to predict, in part because this kind of problem follows something of a tipping phenomenon. The problem with combat motivation in the Iraqi military is that you never know, as an Iraqi, whether two of the five people in the room with you may be secret police informants, and as a result of expressing a sincere desire to have Saddam replaced by somebody else, you could end up with a bullet in the temple later that evening. So, and on the other hand, once it becomes apparent that the game is over and the outcome is determined, now you have to consider a different set of threats. I mean, there's the danger that I may be talking to a secret police informant who will turn me in and get me or my family shot. On the other hand, there's the danger that these Americans are going to run me through a war crimes tribunal, and I could end up in a jail or hanging from a long rope someday in the future. So you can imagine that as things progress in a fairly gradual way on the battlefield, eventually you reach some point at which people become willing to engage in coup conspiracy talk with one another.
Mm-hmm.
They start to discover that there are a lot of people around them who feel the same way. And you could have a snowballing effect take place quite quickly. Now, we haven't seen a lot of evidence of that so far. What we're seeing evidence of so far is just how long it may take that snowball to mount up, because you're dealing with a society in which Saddam Hussein has spent the better part of a generation instilling a culture of fear among all Iraqis, the public, the military, even members of the secret police and the Special Republican Guard.
Mm-hmm.
No one knows who the other informants are. In an environment like that, threats that we may be making from the outside have to overcome a tremendous amount of drag in the form of sheer fear within the society that's been cultivated over most people's lifetimes.
To crack all that interlocking security apparatus.
That's right. It's a very tough drag to overcome. You could imagine, though, that once overcome, it could tip fast. But, boy, it's next to impossible to try and predict in advance where this mysterious tipping point is going to come and when the snowball starts rolling downhill.
Mm.
Could
it's
be
hard
days,
to count on
be
that
hours,
tipping.
Could be weeks.
Richard Betts?
It's hard to count on that tipping happening as long as units in question are still far away and before American forces have been moving into Baghdad. Once that happens, then a lot depends on whether the middle level of the political control structure holds together well enough to organize snipers and irregular units to make the advance through Baghdad a messy block-by-block affair, or that once they see, as Steve put it, the game is over, the Americans are going all the way, they start running for the exits.
But we're certainly seeing, at least in the comments we're reading from officers in the military today, a sense that that command structure is holding better and the harassment at the least is much more voluminous and determined than had been expected.
But we really haven't challenged the command structure where it matters politically, and that's within the populated areas, within cities. We've been, for the most part, with some exception, bypassing cities so far. The real test will come at Baghdad, since that's the center of everything, and that's where presumably Saddam Hussein is going to meet his end.
But we certainly challenge it with armaments, with weapons from the sky at the very least. Richard Betts, Stephen Biddle, stand by. A lot of callers want to join this conversation. Kelly's calling from Boston. Hi, Kelly. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling to say that we should all as Americans be standing in support of the president and not asking what kind of timeline we're looking at. War, when it's waged, has no clean, clear-cut timeline, and we should all be standing in support of our troops instead of protesting against the war.
Kelly, do you think that discussing the length of the war is somehow not being supportive of the troops?
I think it's being unrealistic. We lead a lifestyle, most Americans, where we are very clear about what kind of timelines our lives are on. And when you're talking about war, we need to understand it's not that simple. It's extremely complex. And as one of your guests said earlier, once war is over, there's still peacemaking measures. Mm-hmm. And the troops will be there for an indefinite amount of time. So it's going to take as long as it takes.
It's going to take as long as it takes. That's the president's line today. And Kelly, thank you for your call. I want to welcome into our conversation Daniel Byman. He's assistant professor in the Security Studies Program at Georgetown University and author of Keeping the Peace, Lasting Solutions to Ethnic Conflict. Good evening and welcome, Daniel Byman.
Happy to be here.
We've been talking about how long this war may stretch out, Daniel Byman, and the sense in the country that it, and in the military, I must say, from a lot of reports coming in today, that it's going to be, it could be a good deal longer than expected. You heard the caller just coming in to say, well, we need to stand up by the president and by these troops however long it takes. Why do you think there's this sense of, oh my gosh, this is more than we bargained for? Is this naivete among the public and even among parts of the government? Or was there an expectation deliberately or inadvertently built that this would go quickly?
I would say there are three reasons. First of all, the popular image of the first Gulf War was one of a very quick, surprising, overwhelming U.S. victory. And so there's a natural assumption that history would repeat itself. Second, I would say the administration, in order to build the case for war, did not emphasize, naturally enough, some of the risks or uncertainties that might drag the war out. And the third reason is the first few days of the war seemed to go so well. So many people who said, it might be difficult, all of a sudden were facing the possibility of what looked like a possible cakewalk. So reality has caught up with us, but that doesn't, again, mean that the pendulum has swung so far the other way that we're in a quagmire.
That's the word that comes up, Stephen Biddle. Nobody wants to go there. Everyone wants this war to be handled just as briskly as it can be. But if it stretches out, how do you imagine the political surround, the questions and the response to a longer war may affect the war itself within Iraq?
Well, it can in a variety of ways. The longer the war goes on, the more encouraged the Iraqis become. And the less willing individual commanders become to switch their loyalties, and the more willing irregular forces like the Fedayeen become to stick it out. So, I mean, just length in itself encourages resistance in an enemy whose lack of resistance we're banking on to keep the costs low. And, of course, the historical evidence on American public opinion and casualties suggests that over time, as casualties mount, public support for a war effort can dwindle if the public doesn't believe that we're gaining something in exchange for the casualties, that they believe that we're winning the war has a great deal to do with the degree of public support for the war effort. Given that so much of success in this campaign was associated in the pre-war debate with speed, if we in fact aren't moving rapidly, it's harder for the public to become confident that in fact we are succeeding, and thus that whatever price we're paying in casualties or in collateral damage is worth it, because it appears to be producing victory.
And Richard Betts, what about the cost of war? The $75, $76 billion request that went in with the lion's share of that for the war presumed 30 days of combat. If we're not talking about months of combat, does that spike up dramatically?
Well, nobody knows exactly how to compute the cost of war, especially if you consider the indirect costs that flow outwards after the end of the war and the occupation and everything else. So I think it's very difficult to really know what that's going to be, but it's obviously going to be a large dollar figure. The famed economist at Yale, William Nordhaus, did a study which estimated, depending on what you count and how you count, the costs of a war might be anywhere between $50 and $200 billion, and even more, again, if you count the far-out indirect costs.
Richard Betts, we're coming up on a break, and I know we have to lose you there, but give us the benefit of your own thinking. What's the range here? How near could something like at least the first phase of victory be? How far could it be?
I think it's still conceivable that it could be fairly soon, within a few weeks, again, depending on this tipping phenomenon that Steve Biddle mentioned, and how soon U.S. forces actually begin operations in Baghdad. On the other hand, if they proceed very cautiously, wait for significant reinforcements, decide to clean up everything in the south before doing anything in Baghdad, it could be much longer. But to really try to make a kind of point estimate would be a foolish way to try to approach war, because it doesn't proceed according to any script. You're dealing with an enemy who's trying to outwit you. You're not fighting against nature in a way that's reasonably predictable.
Well, we are all adjusting expectations tonight. Richard Betts, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Richard Betts is director of the Institute for War and Peace Studies at Columbia University and author of Surprise Attack: Lessons for Defense Planning. We're talking tonight about the time factor and how long this war in Iraq may last. Did you have a timetable, a duration in mind for this war? What did you expect? And what do you expect now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at the time factor tonight and how long this war in Iraq may last. You can join the conversation. How long is too long for Iraq, for our troops, for you? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight are Stephen Biddle, professor of national security studies at the Strategic Studies Institute at the U.S. Army War College, and joining us from Washington, Daniel Byman, assistant professor in the security studies program at Georgetown University. You're welcome to join us as well, 1-800-423-8255. Their surprise and adjustment of expectations is going on all over the place, including in the military. The U.S. Marines have taken casualties, dead and wounded, in Nasiriyah in south-central Iraq. Today, some of the Marines who were hit there spoke about their experience at medical facilities in Landstuhl, Germany. Here's a clip from Marine Lance Corporal Joshua Menard about what he was led to expect and what the Marines found.
We were very surprised. We were told when we were going through in Nasiriyah that we should see little to no resistance. And then when we got in, it was a whole different ballgame. Received a lot of resistance, and we were more prepared for what happened in the Gulf War, where they more turned over and surrendered most of the time, but they weren't rolling over like we thought they would.
They're not rolling over yet. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Steve is calling from Juneau, Alaska. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hey, good evening. Thanks a lot. As a disclaimer, I've got to say, I really don't consider our president to be my president. I consider him to be unelected. However,
so we see where you're coming from. What's your thought?
He's Steve. What we got, and he's what we got to work with. I wonder if I see these guys oftentimes wrapping themselves up with the in a very tight ball and not listening to outside ideas. I wonder if instead of the idea that we're all going to end up sitting around in some kind of a medieval siege blowing the hell out of Baghdad, or standing around wondering what we're going to do once we get there, as we will, if those guys could consider the idea of making, I don't know, 18 million small parachutes that could take 10 kilos of water and 10 kilos of food all over that city.
To what effect, Steve? To what effect?
As opposed to standing outside and blowing those guys into kingdom come.
But would that end the conflict? How?
Are we talking about liberating them? I mean, can we liberate them at the end of a a 15-millimeter shell flowing in there? I just think that couldn't we fly this stuff in, drop it all down, and say, I'm sure there's someone in the American government that could put a little reminder that we're here to help, stay inside, don't do anything, we're going to be feeding you, because these people aren't going to have any food or water in another couple weeks.
Steve, we've got the perspective. Let me put it to our guest. Of course, a lot of leafleting, massive amounts, has already been dropped over Baghdad. Dan Byman, at this point, how do you see our options? And Steve is asking us to think outside the box in terms of options as we face this, the challenge of bringing this conflict to a close in Baghdad and beyond. Are we thinking fully broadly enough about it? What are the options?
Well, the caller raises a very important point, which is this is not a war to crush and destroy the Iraqi people. This is a war to liberate them. And so there's a fundamental tension between how you win the war, which often involves tremendous bloodshed and destruction, and how you help the Iraqi people, which, of course, minimizes that. Mm. So what the military has tried to do is to have two fronts at once, both humanitarian and military. But there's a natural tension, and what we're going to find is if we slow down, if the pace of operation slows down, the potential for a humanitarian crisis increases, because there'll be areas, particularly in cities, that may not have as much food, where water may be shut off. And Saddam's regime, horribly, actually has an incentive for this. This is a regime that actually cares less about its people than does the United States. So they may try to provoke or foster a humanitarian crisis to get world attention, even though they may ultimately be responsible for part of it.
In fact, today we read that the Saddam Hussein regime is, a number of analysts believe, is kind of on their track, on their war plan, which is, in fact, to manipulate all kinds of factors here, the supply chain, the surprise of U.S. troops, and ultimately that humanitarian picture. Stephen Biddle, how strong a hand in this asymmetric conflict might Baghdad have?
Well, I think they're proving to have a stronger hand than many here certainly expected them to, in part, I think, again, because we underestimated the nature of the political system we were dealing with. Mm-hmm. There's a certain tendency to think, gosh, we wouldn't like to have Saddam Hussein around. They must not either. I mean, they would welcome liberation, and in the process to discount the degree of political threat that's been created within that society. One of our hopes was that we could limit the strength of Saddam's hand in terms of his ability to control his country by shutting down his communications. And I think what we're discovering now is more or less what we discovered back in 1991, which is that there are an awful lot of ways for an autocrat to communicate with the key people around him, if necessary, sending runners and messengers out. And it's harder to limit the strength of his hand in the sense of limit his ability to execute the options he's got by cutting him off from his people and his forces.
Not to mention just broadcasting on television, and that has gone on despite bombing there. Corey is calling. Hi, Corey. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Well, my assessment of the situation, my small assessment from here in Brookline, is that I think that Saddam has a proven track record, which was very clear before the United States went into this war, that he's a kind of guy who will do anything and everything he can when he needs to. And I don't think anyone should be surprised that he's fighting a guerrilla war, because he doesn't have a lot of advanced technology, and he's resorting to what might be called a poor man's war, which should have been, I would say, obvious to people that this is the way he would have gone. Now, you know, the thing with a guerrilla war, as we saw in Vietnam, is that it can, you know, you don't know who your enemy is. They can infiltrate the civilian population, and it becomes very difficult to fight this kind of war without just trying to totally annihilate a population like we dropped napalm in Vietnam.
Corey, our time's running down, but let me pick up that theme and put it to my guest, Dan Byman. Is there that risk? I'm sure for Americans of several generations, somewhere in the back of their mind, could this turn into a long-term guerrilla war, or is that just not on?
It comes down to one key question, and one we don't yet know the answer to, which is how will the Iraqi people respond to the United States as the United States consolidates control? If the Iraqi people say, we're glad the United States is here, we were tired of Saddam's regime, which I think that is likely, then they will help identify people in their midst who might be guerrillas, and it will be relatively easy to wage a guerrilla war. Guerrilla wars are difficult when the guerrillas have popular support.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, if they decide the United States are invaders, and this happened to a degree in Somalia, then a guerrilla war is likely and would be exceptionally difficult. Now, I'm optimistic. In the Balkans, in Afghanistan, many people said beforehand that the people would naturally turn against outside forces, and they didn't. And Saddam's regime is worse than those regimes in terms of how the people feel about it. So mm-hmm. I am hopeful, but the reality and the possibility are certainly there.
Stephen Biddle, we've only got a minute and a half left here. Reinforcements, we're told, are on the way. The Army's 4th Infantry Division, the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment based in Fort Carson, Colorado, 1st Cavalry Division in Fort Hood, Texas. Those last two still in their stateside bases. What's the timetable to get more troops in there for those generals who want that extra weight?
Well, without commenting on the specific arrival times called for in the plan, force builds up linearly with time. The longer you wait, the more troops you can get. There's been enough of an interest in trying to hold troop levels down, though, and succeed, if at all possible, with the minimum footprint, in large part to prevent the kind of nationalist insurrection that Dan Byman was talking about. This process is necessarily going to take longer now than it might have. In order to keep our footprint down and lower the risk of a long war,
but despite that earlier hope, these troops, we read, are on the way at this point.
Well, troops have been on the way for a long time. The 4th Infantry Division, for example, which was originally supposed to commit to the war through Turkey, has been in the process of redeploying to the south for some days already. So there's a long stream of forces slowly moving their way towards the theater. The longer we're willing to wait, the more of them will get there, and the more decisive the action will be when it occurs.
Longer we're willing to wait, it's all about time tonight. We thank both of you for your insights on this. I think people are really hanging on every word of the conversation about how long this might go. Stephen Biddle in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Stephen Biddle is professor of national security studies at the Strategic Studies Institute at the U.S. Army War College. And Daniel Byman in Washington, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
Daniel Byman is assistant professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University. You can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. Click on forums in a moment. Rethinking the Geneva Conventions. This is On Point. Earlier this week, members of the Bush administration accused Iraq of violating the Geneva Convention rules governing behavior during war. After American POWs were paraded on Iraqi television, the International Committee of the Red Cross supported the U.S. claims and declared Iraq in violation. Some in the international community have countered that the United States itself is playing fast and loose with the Geneva Conventions, pointing to the treatment and detainment of pro-Taliban fighters at Guantanamo Bay. Former Marine Captain Kirk Kicklighter finds the concept of fairness in war odd. In this radio diary, he recalls his own ambivalence while learning the rules of war.
When I was commissioned as a Marine second lieutenant in the late 1980s, I, like all new officers today, attended a 6-month training course, called the Basic School at the Marine Base in Quantico, Virginia. TBS, as it was called, teaches all young lieutenants how to function as basic infantry platoon leaders. The training combines grimy tactical field training, physical testing, and intense classroom study. One topic we spent a great deal of time on was the Geneva Conventions. At periodic intervals over 6 months, we weary lieutenants squeezed into a poorly ventilated lecture hall and took copious notes while a Marine major spouted on about the basic rules of war. The lessons were always presented in terms of the honor and morality of being a Marine, using the typically salty, vulgar language of Jarhidis. "Marines don't harm civilians, period," I still remember the major shouting. "It's not tolerated and never has been. So when some protester starts calling you a baby killer, just look him in the eye and tell him to go bleep himself." "Marines do not abuse prisoners of war," he bellowed. "I don't care if that POW is the lowest stinking form of raghead." Raghead was a pejorative term. It came into vogue after the Corps lost 241 Marines in a terrorist attack on its Beirut barracks in 1983. I doubt the term has gone out of vogue with this war. We spent hours studying the atrocious behavior of Army Lieutenant William Calley, whose men massacred nearly 300 Vietnamese villagers in March 1968. When such tragedies occurred, it was usually a result of confusion and terror. In most cases, the Americans just couldn't tell the difference between civilians and combatants. To simulate such confusion, we spent time in the woods of Quantico playing war games. We led platoons as they fired weapons in a mock-up urban village called Combat Town, losing points on our evaluation if we hit a civilian target. We went through the steps of recognizing and negotiating surrenders, from arranging the razor wire of a holding pen to addressing a POW without being abusive. The world has gotten more complicated since I served in the military, but the Geneva Conventions remain in effect, and I have no doubt the Marines in Iraq have received the same or better training in them than I did. That training can be a burden if reports from the field are accurate. Coalition forces are fighting under more constraints than the Iraqis. They have limited fire to avoid killing civilians, and restrictions on the use of firepower against Iraqi defenders have prolonged battles and endangered supply lines. The Iraqi soldiers, for their part, apparently have faked surrender only to open fire on Americans, killing them with treacherous surprise. This is a clear violation not only of accepted war practice, but also of basic human decency. And worst of all, American troops may have been executed by Iraqis while raising their arms in attempted surrender. If confirmed, such action is truly barbaric. But what am I really saying? Aren't all wars barbaric? The old "all's fair in love and war" adage rears its head again. The entire concept of playing fair while ducking bullets and trying to kill the enemy is a strange one. Despite every formal lesson I and other lieutenants learned at Quantico about humane treatment, there is always another algebra of war we silently calculated and stored away inside ourselves. It consisted of one simple rule, much easier to remember because it was based on the most basic human desire, survival. The rule was this: death before dishonor, but when in doubt, stay alive.
Kirk Kickleiter is a former Marine captain and a staff writer for the magazine Doubletake. He lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Listeners, as war rages in Iraq, we want to hear your story. How is the conflict affecting your life? How are you struggling to understand? If you have a story that would make a good radio diary, email us. The address is onpoint@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.